the making and remaking of an industrial harbor.
Living in Hamilton, it's hard not to see the social and environmental as connected.
A conversation with Nancy Bouchier and Ken Cruikshank about their new book on the social and environmental history of Hamilton Harbor. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 53 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. If you take a look at a map of the head of Lake Ontario and the waterfront of the city of Hamilton, you'll find several distinct features. From east to west, you'll first find a narrow strip of land where the Burlington Skyway straddles the north and south shores of the lake, a high-speed transportation corridor for streams of daily motorists. Moving west, you'll see the enclosed harbor and Hamilton's industrial waterfront, a rigid, geometric set of squares and rectangles jutting out into the lake. Finally, the head of the lake is again segmented by a narrow strip of land, where York Boulevard crosses from Burlington to Hamilton, enclosing a smaller bay to the west and the Coots Paradise Sanctuary. The contrast between the sharp lines of the waterfront in the industrial harbor and the greenery of Coots Paradise hints at part of the long, complicated history of Hamilton Harbor. This is the subject of a new book by two history professors from McMaster University. Nancy Bouchier and Ken Cruikshank explore both the social and environmental histories of Hamilton Harbor in their new book from UBC Press, The People in the Bay. To learn more about this history, I spoke with Nancy and Ken.
Nancy Bouchier from the Department of History here at McMaster University.
And I'm Ken Cruikshank, and I'm also a professor in the Department of History at McMaster. And we're sitting in the dean's office because I'm sitting in the dean's office right now.
Well, welcome to the both of you, and thanks for joining us this afternoon to talk about your new book, The People in the Bay, A Social and Environmental History of Hamilton Harbor. And this just came out from UBC Press earlier this year, and I'm glad to have a chance to talk to the both of you about it. I wanted to start by asking you about the subtitle of the book. It's described as both a social and an environmental history of Hamilton's harbor. I first wanted to start by asking you why you decided to emphasize these two approaches.
So I'm a sport historian. I look at the history of places, or an urban sport historian. And so when we started this project many years ago, Ken was really a historian of the state in many respects, and I was a sport historian. We joined up to do this study of Hamilton Harbor, and I'm kind of morphed into a social environmental historian, and Ken morphed into an environmental state historian, writing about recreation and leisure.
And living in Hamilton, it's hard not to see the social and environmental as connected. Very much so, the east end of the city has a different environment than most of us living in the west end of the city. Mm-hmm. But if it needed to be driven home at all, what we were up to, I was at a meeting early on in which there was a discussion about the cart barrier that separates the harbor from Coots Paradise to keep the carp out, just as it was being constructed. And there were questions about what would happen to the carp. And effectively, some of the biologists said, we don't care. If they all disappear, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. And someone raised their hand and said, but aren't there people who are fishing the carp for food? And no one in the room could answer the question, was anyone in Hamilton, that everyone had a speculation that there were certain ethnic groups that were still fishing for carp for a food source, but no one could actually answer the social question, all these people thinking about how they were going to fix the environment.
And of course, people are still fishing to eat today.
This stands out throughout the book, I think, and this particular book, I think, will be very approachable for other Canadian historians. Social history is especially strong in the Canadian history field, and to see these two fields merged in this text to some extent, I think has a lot of value. And of course, people are central in the narrative that you tell here, and in particular, individual actors play a significant role in the book and its structure. There are three chapters in the book that have kind of a biographical focus on individuals. I wondered if you could tell listeners a little bit about why you took that approach in the book.
It really emerged from the data, I think. There were many other historical actors we could have chosen, especially in the contemporary period. Mm-hmm. But these are three compelling people upon which, you know, storylines kind of emerge. We have the least information about Kerr as a human being, and perhaps the most about McQuesten, and Simmons is somewhere in between. But the story's unfolded in a kind of a neat fashion, and the telling of a story in narrative fashion was what we were aiming for.
Yeah, I think for many readers, biography makes history a lot more real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so beyond the data, there is the question of what kind of impact you're going to have with your writing. And we've given enough public talks and, you know, curated a museum exhibition, done the video to be thinking about what is it that people find really appealing. And I think that biographies really make it real for people. I think it does emerge again from the data as well. It's interesting, you know, living at a university where social scientists and others are now discovering the value of storytelling. And, you know, I think that biography is an obvious way of making a story very real to people.
And if there's a kind of a pedagogical point in our book, it's about people making a difference, and to situate the kind of that thought that individual people can make, you know, through praxis, a change in the environment, the situation, people getting together and doing things makes a difference.
Yeah, I mean, that's clear from beginning to finish in the book, a very strong emphasis on human choice and agency and decisions about their relationships with the environment. I wanted to ask about one of the specific individuals, John Kerr, who though there's limited information about his life, you found evidence of a kind of shift in thinking about conservation and social justice on Kerr's part. So could you tell us a little bit more about Kerr's life and what happened to cause him to rethink how he saw nature and the environment on the bay?
We give that one over to Ken because
I was talking about John Kerr, the Irish Protestant from the Irish Constabulary who comes to Canada, ends up being a fishery inspector and overseer. I think the interesting, I mean, you asked about biography and why we focus on individuals, but Kerr is a really interesting case of focusing on an individual because individuals themselves can learn and change. And I think that Kerr begins as he had was a eventually he had a very variety of jobs. It was eventually a chief clerk in the engineering department at the Great Western. Then he was, I don't know how he got it, but he got a land grant on the mountain on the escarpment overlooking Hamilton Harbor, and he becomes a kind of gentleman farmer interested in angling. He becomes engaged with a group of similar middle class colleagues, peers in the city who are interested in angling and who are concerned about the decline of certain species of fish in the by 1860. They focus on the behavior of others as one of the reasons why fish are in decline. They focus on particularly spear fishing and other kinds of activity, which they see as destructive of fish populations. Mm-hmm. He is the secretary of the organization that begins to press the government for regulation. The government adopts regulations which follow some of their recommendations, and he becomes the fishery inspector to enforce these regulations. But a funny thing happens on the way after he becomes fishery inspector, and indeed anyone who has ever read a very early piece we wrote in Sport History Review on Kerr will notice that we changed our mind. We hadn't read enough of the evidence, I think, at the time we wrote that article. We focused on the degree to which Kerr was a kind of mouthpiece and representative of the group from which he came. But in fact, he begins to become increasingly sympathetic to the fishers who he was supposed to regulate. That he begins to understand that spearfishing has some appeal, that it should be regulated in some way, but that perhaps he was wrong to see it as the only problem facing the fishery in Hamilton Harbor and indeed in the lake. He furthermore has the experience of trying to enforce other aspects of the Fishery Act, particularly the rules against polluting and damaging fish populations. When he tries to enforce those rules, he finds he loses a lot of friends. He doesn't have a lot of allies supporting him in his efforts, even though really what he's trying to do by enforcing the laws, get industries of various kinds just to change their practices rather than, I think he's not, you know, anti-capitalist. He's not trying to out to destroy their industries. He is really out to try to get them to amend some of the ways they work. They oppose him quite bitterly. And so Kerr becomes a bit disillusioned, I think, with some of the people who he might once have been thought of as colleagues.
So it's an extraordinary story, and I guess for listeners, you heard it here first. You have to read the book to get the whole story, not just the earlier article. Kerr, I guess, to some extent, then it's not the earliest Hamiltonian to confront this conflict between recreational and industrial uses of the bay, but he's right there at the center of it to some extent in the 19th century. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think he is great. To use to illustrate the degree to which pollution and concerns about pollution, and not just pollution around human waste, but that was certainly part of it, the degree to which pollution is a concern in the 19th century, the degree to which, you know, concern about the fishery exists by 1860, about what's going on with the fishery in the harbor.
And he provides a wonderful picture of a kind of complicated picture. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is why social and environmental history go so well together. It's when he starts seeing things like spear fishers as people feeding families. He starts and he goes through his experiences pushing up against industry or in court cases, changes his mind, shifts. And we see shifts in people's perceptions of things today through experience.
And Nancy's original answer about the data also fits here. It's a lovely diary. It is a really great diary with a lot more in it that he left us. And furthermore, Kerr's influence, in a sense, lives on because two of his sons become fishery inspectors. They manage the kind of transition, really, from the federal government to the provincial government being engaged in the fishery to end up being the fishery inspectors for of the harbor into the 1930s.
It's a nice case study, too, I think, for students of environmental history to remember that the actors that we look at in the past were not by necessity mindless ravagers of the environment or elite conservationists without any sensitivities to the social dynamics of the uses of nature.
Or that social views can change too, mm-hmm. right? We often fix people as, you know, they have a certain set of attitudes. Even we do it, I think, a little bit in the book. But we often fix people with attitudes because they come from a particular social class. And he certainly had certain attitudes that came from being part of a social class. But that you can actually change your views on particular issues seems to be important.
Now, the harbor, the book spans an enormous time period from even the pre-19th century, deeper past, but mainly focuses from the early 19th century up to the present. And you mark an important change from about the 1930s to the end of the 1950s that you describe as a transformation of Hamilton's waterfront from a mixed-use bay to an industrial harbor. What brought about this change? What did that involve? And why did it occur in that period in the city's history?
Why don't we let you lead with that?
Okay. Why does it happen in that period? I mean, clearly Hamilton's already being shaped by industrial development because of access to water supply, electricity, and rail. But one of the things that actually surprised us is it's used as a harbor, but it is a very difficult harbor and challenging one for a number of manufacturers. And that changes fairly significantly in the late 1920s and the 1930s with the opening and the anticipation of and then the opening of the fourth Welland Canal, which suddenly makes Hamilton have greater access to the rest of the Great Lakes. We often think of them as a system, but it was actually quite difficult to ship beyond Lake Erie and sometimes even beyond Lake Huron from where? Well, for the Hamilton Steel Company from further on the Lake Superior where the iron ore supplies were. So the expansion of the Welland Canal, the modernization of the Welland Canal, the expansion of the canal that enters Hamilton Harbor that went at the same time, and a concerted effort to turn Hamilton into a port really made a difference. Not immediately, partly because of the depressed markets of the 1930s, but it enabled growth during World War II and during the economic boom afterwards. We see really the transformation of a relatively small company called Dominion Foundries into a major second fully integrated steel mill in Hamilton only after World War II. Mm-hmm. This all took place along with, I think, a couple of big changes and one what people might regard as a small change, but we see as reasonably significant. The small change is that the Hamilton Harbor Commission ceased to get a subsidy from the city of Hamilton and became increasingly dependent on port revenues. The Harbor Commission had, since its creation in 1912, had played a role in encouraging discussion about waterfront recreation, about pollution, but increasingly it doesn't. After that small change in the later 1930s, and it becomes ever more single-minded, not quite, but almost single-minded in its focus on the development of port facilities for the city. And the other two larger developments, I think, are one, the larger development throughout North America of new and reasonable affordable housing opportunities on the outskirts of the city that allow industry to expand on the waterfront and in a little bit south into neighborhoods, and also makes groups like the Local Trades and Labor Council more concerned with making sure that their workers could get to work from the suburbs as opposed to get to work from a local somewhere close to the factories. And the other larger development is new alternatives for recreational pursuits, the development of parks and beaches more distant from the city. So all of these things combine, we think, to lead to a change in a transformation of the harbor.
And automobiles.
Yes.
Cars change everything. It changes everything from the oil that gets into the bay when mechanics are working on vehicles. Automobiles change everything for areas, certain areas of the bay. The beach strip becomes this congested area. It was once a a recreational paradise, and it becomes a kind of a traffic lane between Toronto and Niagara. And automobiles enable people to get away. If it starts to get stinky and dirty, if you can't swim in the bay, mm-hmm. go somewhere else. Get in your car and travel to a new provincial park or some other area that's more pristine and cleaner. And again, that notion of people, social history, you know, choices that people had in that kind of period of time that weren't so evident in earlier times.
That's some interesting remarks about the car. I mean, to some extent, do you think the car makes it easier to segment environmental pollution, to set it aside in this one area because other recreational space becomes accessible?
I think because other recreational space becomes accessible, because it is possible then to live further away from the plants. It makes it easier to turn your back on the harbor, in a sense, than to stop thinking about the harbor because you have alternate places to live and to play. So I do think that, and, you know, political economist in me wants to say that, of course, the automobile is also driving some of the demand for steel and other products. In there. We're not an auto city, but certainly the demand for some products, and probably leads to the growing dominance of the steel industry in the city over top of a whole variety of other industries that existed. And right down to, if you think about it, right down to what is done with slag. Building roads becomes an opportunity for someone to make money off of slag.
Yeah.
Now, ordinary residents of Hamilton never vanish from the story here. They don't leave the bay. From John Smoke to Jillian Simmons, ordinary Hamiltonians made numerous efforts to try and resist social elites or the politically powerful from controlling or determining how the bay could be used. What do you think your book reveals about how social and political power operates in the context of environmental change?
I'm going to let you.
I'm always getting to go first. Okay, so that's a big question. How does social and political power operate? I mean, I think that obviously our book does talk about social and political power as being significant for shaping decisions about who gets to use the harbor and for what purposes. But I think throughout the book, an effort is made to show that those efforts are sometimes resisted, not resisted in some sort of overt way often, but often resisted simply by people going ahead and doing whatever they wanted, regardless of what people might have wanted them to do in the harbor. I think that other social groups don't always comply with the vision that the social elite has for the proper uses of the harbor, resist regulations and even press at times for things that some of the elite are beginning to believe are inappropriate. For example, they press for a beach on the south shore in the west end and the north end, what's called the north end of Hamilton. They press for a beach, even though there are some medical professionals and others who actually believe the harbor is probably too dirty at that point to be putting a public beach in place. And yet the people who live in the north end and other workers press for a beach for the people, a beach to give them access to the harbor. So they press even at times for positive changes, as well as resisting, if you will, or ignoring what people want them to do.
We were talking before we got on the air about the case study of the beach strip and the layers and how complicated the story is when you're talking about members of a social elite who are also things like city councilors who are helping to transform a kind of a recreational area, but then their designs change and they do things that you wouldn't quite expect. And so the story goes like this.
She's handing it over to me again. So the story, I think the beach strip, the interesting story around the beach strip is, of course, that initially Initially, it's a place for the fishing community, and it continues to be a place for the fishing community. Then in the 1870s, there's concern that, for example, railroads will buy up a lot of the property. They're proposing railroads to go across the beach strip. This is, by the way, the little strip of land that separates the harbor from Lake Ontario. And if you do know this part of the world, it's where the Burlington Skyway Bridge now crosses. So it's a little strip of land. In the 1870s, the concern, the city asserts and gets the province to give the city some control over the beach strip, even though it's well beyond the confines of the city. The city then, having asserted kind of the importance of public control of the beach, hands it over effectively to social elites to build a private resort community there. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't stay the same, right? So it's an elite community in the late 19th century, but by the 1900s, the electric streetcar can bring a lot more people to the beach strip than a lot more people could afford to go to the beach strip. And increasingly then the elite that saw it as a lovely place to be see it as overcrowded and too many people not of their rank being there.
And they end up getting petitioning and getting a form of government.
Yes. So the city then wants to assert some more control, wants to ensure there are some public beaches. They had always tried to retain some control over that. And they also want to see that certain kinds of changes are made on the beach strip. Well, suddenly the social elites who live there resist, create their own government because they had never been under the city. They had always been part of a county government. Then they managed to get a special commission, which is effectively the social elite, to govern the beach strip. Even that, though, doesn't allow them to resist change, the coming of the automobile, the electric streetcar, but then the coming of the automobile, and increasingly the degree to which that strip is used for transportation and transportation in a way leads to the running down of the community. The elite kind of flees, and really by the 1950s, one woman told us, I knew I was down and out in Hamilton when I had to move to the beach strip.
So, I mean, this is the kind of complexity and nuance I think the book explores. I mean, you're very clear that the ability to affect environmental change can be affected by social power, and you have some actors with more power and some with less power. And they seem to operate in a kind of relationship with nature itself, which acts as a resisting force. And then different social actors within Hamilton resist one another in terms of their efforts to control nature itself. So it's a nice nuance. I didn't get the sense that you were trying to say that the socially powerful are determinative of how the environment changes.
Now, social and political power is not absolute, and it's also not, I mean, you just pointed out the other feature of this is it's not absolute because the understanding and control of nature is imperfect.
Messy.
And the natural world does not always cooperate, clearly. In an ideal world, you wouldn't have gotten a polluted harbor. In an ideal world, lots of the things that happen, in an ideal world, you would have built a canal and it would have stayed as a canal and you wouldn't have to keep digging it out. In an ideal world, you could have still lived on the shoreline without living near open sewers. And beginning to realize the consequences of the open sewers. So I think that natural processes in nature also kind of push back, if you will, speak back to power.
So this book deals with a variety of shapes and forms of property, private property and public property in particular. Do you see these ideas about property having an effect on the bay over time?
I always say it's a false binary, that some institutions that are public deal with things as if they were private. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think the example we gave of the beach strip is a good case of that, right? Where the public authority is asserted over the beach strip, and then the public authority hands over control to private owners, to private owners. And
some of whom are city councilors.
Some of whom are city councilors, right. Some of whom were public. So, I mean, it's a messy public at all times. And it's a particularly messy public in a harbor situation, because you have the messy public. Who are the public authorities, if you will, who own the public property? There is an assertion that the city owns the harbor, but of course that assertion can only go so far, because the federal government, as a public authority, has the right to make decisions about navigation, and no one knows for much of the 19th century who it is that's supposed to make the decisions around fisheries. But it's certainly not the local government. It's either the province or the federal government. It's resolved in favor of the province, really. So, I mean, the public is a very messy place. And the social elite's not always happy with what people do with private property. So the example of the amusement parks, the private amusement parks on the North Shore in the 19th century, to win a clientele, they often found they had to not create the kind of perfect elite resort that the elite might have wanted, but they had to put in roller rinks and other features to make them attractive to a wider variety of people. So even, you know, private didn't always satisfy people who we might expect to support private authority.
That's interesting, and an important insight too, I guess, from a contemporary perspective, perhaps, not to assume that public property is by necessity the method by which the environment can be protected.
Absolutely.
So this is a book in urban environmental history, which is a field that isn't extensively developed in Canada. There are really only a handful of studies that focus on Canadian cities and the environment. What do you see as the main contribution of this book to that broader field of urban environmental history?
I like to think about sport historians don't think about the environment as much as they ought to. Sports studies scholars do. But there is much to be had when you think about the development of, you know, sports facilities, parks, playgrounds, to situate in the context of the environment.
And what that brings to the story, I think, which I do think makes it a little different than some work, not all work, but I think we emphasize how important amenities, how important recreation and leisure is to the story at all times. There is a tendency in some work, one kind of work either looks at parks and actually does see that public parks, there's a history that goes through into the 19th century and tell that story happily. But a number of environmental histories of cities tend to focus on recreation and leisure in the modern period, and some period that's defined as consumer, the consumer period. And I think we tend to, as we say at some point, I think, in the conclusion, that we do not see the focus on beauty, health, and permanence as a post-war consumerist view of nature, that recreation and leisure had always been important. So I think that's one. I mean, that certainly comes from Nancy's influence on the book, the focus on recreation and leisure at all times.
And thinking about that in the context of boosterism, we've got a kind of a slightly different take on the booster thrust in the late 19th century.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think that we see boosters as having to do, you know, having to live up to some of the expectations they set. And some of the expectations they set are environmental. They're not just about industry. They're about having an environmentally healthy city. They're often about having recreational amenities available to workers so that people will be attracted. And it's about having clean water. They, you know, I think they measure their success by the number of pipes of water that they have, and sometimes even by, less often, but sometimes by sewage treatment facilities. And so the boosterism has an environmental side, and it has implications, because if you promise these things, you do have to at least make some effort to deliver on them, on the things that you say your city provides. I was trying to think of what else we might offer to urban historian, urban environmental historians. I mean, I think that this book doesn't talk about other cities a lot. I think we made that a choice quite consciously to allow people to draw some comparisons themselves. Mm-hmm. I think anyone reading this book will see a lot of common trends and common themes. But I think that I hope that they also recognize that place matters to the story. If I can use one example, would be if you were to think about Hurley's book on Gary, Indiana, mm-hmm. in which he talks about in 1945, there was a kind of shared environmental experience in Gary, Indiana, and that will diverge in the post-World War II period. Well, for us, there was never any shared environmental experience of the harbor, certainly anyway, but actually it would have applied to something like air pollution as well because of the topography of the city, because of where people ended up living. Managers and did not live close to the industry. They lived on higher ground, which happened to be away from where most of the industrial development happened. So there's no, you know, era in which there's a shared environmental experience in Hamilton. There may well have been in Gary, Indiana. And those are both steel places.
Your book engages well with the historiography and the history of Hamilton, but it's also a book that tries to bring that history into the present. The Bay continues to be a site of conflict, tension, and debate over how people in Hamilton will be able to use it recreationally, for business, for nature preservation. What do you hope that readers will take away from looking at the history of the Bay when thinking about these current issues about nature in the city?
Well, you know, I opened this morning's Hamilton Spectator, and the editorial cartoon for the day was about Bayfront Park and the debate over shutting down the beach in Bayfront Park. And for many people, this notion of whether if you could swim in the bay, things must be good. Notion of the measure of how great things are going to be.
I guess the other, read the conclusion of our book. Especially the last few paragraphs. But I think that, I mean, we do talk a little bit about the importance. I think that if you read this book, we hope that you come away with it thinking about how one's own views of society and indeed maybe one's own views of nature may reflect your position in society, and that you're more aware that there may be other ways of looking at nature than the one you hold. That to think about whether one's projecting a vision of order or disorder on nature, that maybe may or may not be inappropriate. But I think we also talk a little bit in the conclusion at the very end about the extent to which we need to think about all places in the city as, in effect, really human-managed places, that the city is an artifact of human choice, and though nature plays a role within it, we make a lot of the choices that will affect nature, and not to see nature as being the bird sanctuary in Coots Paradise and there not being any nature on the steel plant area of the city or in the industrial area of the city. So I mean, I think that the notion that we have that one has to make decisions about all parts of the city, and that you can't decide that one part of the city can just be ignored or can allow to be degraded, that one has to make some important choices around all parts of the city.
And of course, that's commoners, rural, everything is connected to everything else. And, you know, if people read the book today, they will know that everything was connected to everything else in the past. And the choices that we're faced with today are not easy, nor were they in the past. And that the consequences of people's choices in the building of the city and in our future building of cities are hard to predict and hard to control.
And I guess we almost circle back to that biography question, that people can make a difference, that there is evidence through the history of the harbor that people have individuals making choices, and sometimes individuals as part of organizations, as part of collectives, have made choices that have had a significant impact on the city.
Yeah. It's environmentalists of the 1990s and the 2000s are faced with choices, but people in the past were. A concern for the environment is not kind of a post-war phenomenon.
And I can tell you that Nancy and I were astonished the other night to go to a presentation by the executive director of the Bay Area Restoration Council, expecting fully to hear a kind of fairly detailed and complex account of the history and the current state of Randall Reef, our toxic hotspot.
The country's toxic hotspot.
And to have him reading excerpts from our book.
Oh, that's great. I think this book will be widely read, not just by historians, but by environmentalists and residents of cities, I hope, across the country. The book is called The People and the Bay, A Social and Environmental History of Hamilton Harbor, from University of British Columbia Press. I want to thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Ken, for telling us a bit more about your book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Nancy Bouchier, Ken Cruikshank, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes and other podcast players, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast by leaving comments or writing a short review on our iTunes page. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. You can always find out more about environmental history research in Canada from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Nature's Past.